chair. "Hi, Dave," I said cheerfully. "I'm Nell." "Nell," he said, "it's good to see you again." I relaxed, or maybe that was just the beta blocker talking, and we got to work. Dave read some jokes that he'd jotted down. "I noticed that if you take the T out of Tom and put it up next to Hanks, look what you get," Dave said. Wordplay. I liked it. Dave asked if we had anything. Since Dave would be sporting his own Kennedy Center medal, I pitched, "What if you listed all the places Tom Hanks went in movies, from a desert island to outer space to Philadelphia? Then you laugh and say, 'I got mine for sitting behind a desk for 30 years. Dave shook his head. "I don't want to mention that," he said. "Tom Hanks winning after me was just a bookkeeping error." We discussed the opening moment between him and Colbert. Dave liked the bit, but thought we could go beyond "not yet." Lewis and I offered to come up with some options. Dave left after an hour. His wife and son were in D.C., and he was eager to get back to them. We'd pick up the discussion tomorrow, which was also show day. 4 unused jokes I wrote for Letterman. 1. "Thank you for including me tonight. I was already in D.C. to check out the Smithsonian. After my last show, CBS is sending me straight there. They found a nice spot between Marcus Welby's lab coat and the hats from F Troop." 2. "Tom keeps challenging himself. I think he's covered every story there is. Man versus man. Man versus machine. Man versus volcano." 3. "And my God, does he deliver. Here are some words that have never been uttered. Tom Hanks? I don't care for him." 4. "Anyone else thinking Tom Hanks, 2016? Note, last one less funny in retrospect. The next morning, Dave arrived at rehearsal with a few new jokes. He didn't like our alternatives for the opener and suggested that he pull Colbert aside after "not yet" to say, "You're embarrassing yourself. That's my job." The director tried staging the additional lines, but nixed them for camera purposes. Dave's rehearsal wrapped. He did not seem happy. A few minutes later, Lewis and I were summoned to Dave's dressing room. We raced over, joining Tom Keeney and a late show writer who'd come to D.C. to help. Dave was agitated. "I don't want to do the not yet bit," he said. I was stunned. "It got a big laugh in the run-through," I said. "It's a big laugh," Dave said. "A huge laugh, I understand. But I think if I start on this big laugh, how's the rest of my bit going to work? I'm just going to tank." My brain went into overdrive, trying to think of a way to soothe Dave's concerns. "It's just a light, fun moment," I said. "You know, Leno and Conan were never seen having fun together when that show was in transition." "Then let Conan do the bit," Dave interjected. "I just think it makes you look like a good guy to be seen with Stephen," I said. "But he gets the joke," said Dave. "What? No. Dave has the line and Colbert slinks off stage." I didn't know how to react. Flailing, I turned to Lewis. "You have more experience with the show, Lewis. What do you think?"
"I think people who start on a big laugh gain a lot of goodwill," Lewis said.
That didn't appease Dave either. Just when it seemed like all was lost, the cavalry appeared. George Stevens, Jr., who created the Kennedy Center Honors in 1978 and was still producing the show in his 80s, heard there was some tension and stopped by to help. George is a consummate diplomat. He listened intently as Dave repeated his concerns and assured Dave that the exchange was warm and charming.
"There's nothing to worry about," George said. George soothed and cajoled, and eventually Dave relented. The not-yet bit stayed in. Lewis and I ran back to the stage to watch a rehearsal of the Lily Tomlin tribute. The ending was sweet, as Jane Fonda declared, "We love you, Lily, beyond measure." Then all four actresses added in unison, "And that's the truth!" Other parts fell flat, including a bit patterned after a chant Lily had done on SNL. Reba McEntire approached me after the rehearsal. "It's not working," Reba said. "I know," I said. It's just cheesy, her then-husband interjected.
Thanks, dude.
What do we do? Reba said, staying focused on finding a solution.
I don't know, I said. I just wish they'd let you sing 9 to 5.
Her face lit up.
That's a great idea. Why can't I do that?
I explained that idea had been pitched and rejected. Reba thought we should try again. We found one of the musical producers and she gave it her all. This would be a much better story if Reba's passionate plea had worked. Unfortunately, the producer explained there wasn't time to pull together a musical number and we just had to make the best of what we had. I was frustrated that the tributes were so lopsided. The Tom Hanks salute included Steven Spielberg speaking from the heart, Martin Short telling jokes, Pentatonix singing That Thing You Do, 3 leading ladies of Broadway, Kelly O'Hara, Laura Benanti, Jesse Mueller, serenading Hanks with They Can't Take That Away From Me, and not one, not two, but 3 marching bands playing Yankee Doodle Dandy while Martin Short and a choir sang freshly tailored lyrics by clever Amanda Green. While heartfelt, Lily's tribute was decidedly underproduced. I think most people would agree that when it comes to cultural relevance, 9 to 5 just barely edges out That Thing You Do. The choreographer made some changes to the blocking for Lily's chant and improved that moment. Jane, Reba, and Kate headed backstage to keep rehearsing. During dinner break, I grabbed my dress bag and headed to the women's bathroom. I wet a paper towel and washed under my armpits. I pulled on some control top hose and prayed there wasn't a run. I slid into a black Max Mara slip dress and swapped out my daytime Stuart Weitzman wedges for my sparkly Stuart Weitzman pumps. I wet my hands and ran them through my hair to add some curl, slashed at my eyelashes with mascara, and looked in the mirror. Cringe. Why hadn't I gotten up early and sprung for a blowout? Suddenly, I heard Penn Jillette's voice in my head. Penn's mother, Valda, was a stoic New Englander, and whenever her son had concerns about his appearance, she would respond, "Who's looking at you?" This thought instantly relaxed me. All I had to do was stand near the luminous Misty Copeland in the green room, and nobody would even know I was there. The black tie, blue ribbon audience filtered in. The honorees took their seats. The Obamas entered the presidential box, and the show began. Colbert got huge laughs with his monologue. Usher performed Al Green's Let's Stay Together, one of my favorite songs. I wanted to soak it all in, but a nagging fear kept me on edge. Tom Hanks's tribute came 3rd in the lineup. As Patricia McBride's segment wrapped up, I leaned over to Lewis.
I think it's 50-50 that Dave will do the not yet bit.
It's in the script, Lewis said.
Yeah, but what if while getting into position, Dave just says to Stephen, let's skip it.
There's nothing we can do about that, Lewis said. We moved to the wings for a better look as the announcer boomed, ladies and gentlemen, 2012 Kennedy Center Award honoree David Letterman. Dave strode across the stage. I held my breath. He stuck to the script. Dave timed it perfectly. He didn't rush the moment, and he didn't milk it. The joke required a cultural knowledge of the backstory, and that seemed to connect the crowd. When people laughed and clapped, it was because they were in on the joke. Lewis flashed me a smile. Happy? I nodded. It feels fantastic when a joke lands, like great sex with no messy cleanup. Colbert nailed his exit, backing into the wings like a chastised boy. The Hanks tribute was big and flashy. As the 3 marching bands filled the aisles, the cameras caught Hanks mouthing, "This is over the top." Dave and the Broadway leading ladies came out at the end to wave before the curtains closed for intermission. Dave wasn't hanging around for the after party, so I texted Tom Keeney to see if I could stop by and say goodbye. Tom texted yes, but warned me that Dave was ready to bolt. I headed straight to his dressing room. Intermission had started maybe 5 minutes earlier, and Dave was already back in his sweats and engaging in a post-mortem with his writer and Tom.
I complimented Dave on his performance. He had tweaked the ending to a story since rehearsal and made it better. We discussed a couple of jokes and the audience's reaction, then Dave stood up and reached out his hand.
"Nice seeing you," he said, "and congratulations on the book."
"You don't know about my book, Dave," I responded skeptically.
"Yeah, the one you wrote with that woman," he said.
"That woman," Nuff said. We shook hands, and suddenly it hit me. This was the moment I never thought would happen. This was my chance to ask Dave about my article. Except I didn't want to bring it up in front of others. I needed a plan, quickly.
"Dave, could I speak to you for a sec?" I blurted out. "Want to take a walk down the hall with me?"
"Sure," he said. Before anyone could protest, Dave and I stepped out of the dressing room.
I'd done it. I had Dave's ear.
Now what? We started down the hall. Dave is much taller than I am, and he stooped a little, curious to hear my private message. "I have nothing to say to you," I said, "but I thought it would drive Tom crazy that I wanted to speak to you alone. He will always wonder what we discussed. Promise me you will never tell him that it was nothing." Dave's hand moved instinctively to his chest. "This joke hits me right where I live," he said. We smiled and made small talk to the end of the hallway, then you turned back. Now, the cool move would have been to just leave it at that. But as always, I wasn't that cool. "So, I have to ask," I said, "did you ever read that article I wrote?"
"No, no," Dave said. "It was about the culture of late night and getting more female writers. I don't worry about that stuff," Dave said, cutting me off.
I bristled at him reducing gender diversity to "that stuff." We neared the dressing room door.
"Let's do another," said Dave.
Like characters in a Sorkin scene, Dave and I walked and talked for one more hallway loop. Maybe Dave didn't want the discussion to end on that awkward exchange, and we resumed our chit-chat. Back at the dressing room, we shook hands again, and Dave slipped inside. As I returned to the green room, I thought about how quickly Dave had gone into full deflection mode. In a way, that helped me. I'd always felt guilty that I hadn't said anything about the show's culture when Dave asked why I was quitting back in 1990. Former late-night head writer Meryl Marco once assured me that it wouldn't have made any difference. I thought she was trying to make me feel better. Now I believe she was right. The rest of the honors passed quickly. Kate McKinnon killed from the moment the spotlight hit her. She struggled to shimmy off Edith Ann's oversized rocking chair in her floor-length gown. "There's no good way to do that," she said. "It's sort of like getting off the lap of the Lincoln Memorial." The crowd laughed, but unless you were in the Kennedy Center that night, you didn't get to see this bit. The onstage portion of Lily's tribute was short to begin with and then edited to the bone. The live performance lasted a scant 6.5 minutes compared to Hanks's 12.5. Now, I love Tom Hanks as much as the next human, animal, or volleyball. He absolutely deserves 12.5 minutes of celebration. So did Lily. Years later, it's still hard for me to let this one go. On my deathbed, I'll gesture to Colin to come close and then whisper in his ear, "You and the boys are everything to me. Oh, and they should have sung 9 to 5. At the post-show dinner, I started to crash. The last 4 hours had been intense. I grabbed a dinner roll and ate it like a Dickensian orphan. They'd seated me off to the side with the lesser donors, but I needed to find someone sitting with the fancy people. I snaked through the crowd, slipping between tuxedos, until I reached the big-ticket tables. I scoured the area. Finally, I spotted her. She was alone and seemed to be searching for her place. I approached. "Lily?" She turned, and I was looking straight into Lily Tomlin's beautiful and expressive eyes. I wanted to introduce myself. I was one of the writers for tonight's show. Instantly, Lily threw her arms around me and wrapped me in one of the best hugs of my entire life. It wasn't a Hollywood hug. It was a mom hug. the kind that makes you feel like everything is all right. I flew back to L.A. the next day and put together a package for Tom Keeney. I had promised to send him a copy of Lean In. I threw in a spare copy for Dave, selecting the version published in Finland, which I inscribed, "Dave, I know you'll never read this book, so I'm sending you a copy in Finnish. Nauti." About a month later, this note from Dave came in the mail. January 8th, 2015. Dear Nell, thanks for all your help in Washington. Thanks for the book. I think it's even better in Finnish. All my best. Dave. Hilarious. The year after he left the air, Dave started advocating for hiring more women in late night. He grabbed headlines when he told Tom Brokaw, "I don't know why they didn't give my show to a woman. That would have been fine." He even grilled two directors during an interview at Ball State on Hollywood's pervasive sexism. When one of those directors tried to duck the subject, Dave followed up with, "Having been very, very successful, now can't you devote your career to help others who struggle to be successful?" Since Jay Leno turned over The Tonight Show to Jimmy Fallon, he has adopted a similar altruistic tone. "I'm really disappointed there's not more diversity in late-night comedy," Jay said in a 2015 interview. "Well, I'm disappointed that when Jay went off the air in 2014, he had zero female and zero African-American writers on his very large staff. It's great to hear these former hosts promoting equality, but why didn't they take any action when they held power? If, in the previous three decades, Dave and Jay had showcased equal numbers of female stand-ups and hired equal numbers of female writers, they would have transformed the comedy world." Maybe Dave truly regrets that he didn't worry about that stuff when he had a show, but my sense is that what's irking both him and Jay can be found at the intersection of ageism and sexism. The two former hosts now know something every woman learns early in her career. It sucks to be pushed aside by a less experienced man. Chapter 18. Our Funny President. People say I'm too cozy with Hollywood. I was just laughing about that with Clooney. Joke I contributed to President Obama's 2013 White House Correspondents' Dinner, unused. President Barack Obama knows how to tell a joke, and at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, he got to tell a lot of them. The Correspondents' Dinner is a black tie fundraiser and celebration of the press that used to be known as Nerd Prom and has now evolved into the C-SPAN Oscars. Each year, the dinner books a well-known comedian to play court jester, but first the president is given the chance to dispense with diplomacy and skewer his critics with good humor. For example, in 2011, President Barack Obama said this, "I've even let down my key core constituency, movie stars. Just the other day, Matt Damon, I love Matt Damon, love the guy. Matt Damon said he was disappointed in my performance. Well, Matt, I just saw the Adjustment Bureau, so right back at you, buddy." Matt Damon missed seeing the joke live, but dozens of his friends emailed him the next day to alert him to the presidential burn. Damon was a good sport. "I have to say it was pretty funny," Damon told GQ magazine. "Whoever came up with it, it was a terrific joke." So that was me, with some wordsmithing tweaks from the White House speechwriters. The Damon joke almost didn't make it into the final speech. That Saturday morning, Director of Speechwriting John Favreau emailed me that the president was wavering. There was concern that the joke was too mean. "I saw the Adjustment Bureau last week," I wrote back. "Truth is a defense." I didn't hear anything further from John. That afternoon, I boarded a plane to travel home from Toronto, where I'd just finished producing an episode of Warehouse 13. Minutes before the president rose to speak, I arrived home in Santa Monica, dropped my bags, and fired up C-SPAN. I had no idea if the joke was in or out. Halfway through the speech, when I heard President Obama say, "Just the other day, Matt Damon," I shrieked, "He's doing it!" The president landed the joke and got a big laugh, even applause. Then he followed the Matt Damon joke with another line I'd sent in. Of course, there's someone I can always count on for support. My wonderful wife, Michelle. We made a terrific team at the Easter egg roll this week. I'd give out bags of candy to the kids, and she'd snatch them right back out of their little hands. The audience roared as the First Lady shook her head and mouthed, "No." Her husband seemed to be enjoying the moment and repeated the phrase, "snatched them," stealing a second laugh. The next day, I spoke to Albert Brooks, and we both marveled at the president's delivery. "He has Johnny Carson's timing," Albert said. "The way he repeated snatched them, that's what Johnny would have done." For a girl who grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, arguably the most liberal city in the most liberal state, writing for President Obama was a highlight of my life. And I owe the opportunity to SpongeBob SquarePants. 10 days before the 2011 dinner, President Obama took a swing through Northern California, which included a visit to the Facebook campus. The communications team asked me to send in some amusing lines that the executives could use in a welcome speech. I thought it would be funny if Mark mentioned that the president had 19 million Facebook followers, only 500,000 short of SpongeBob SquarePants. My Facebook contact gently reminded me that the idea was to welcome their guest, not roast him. That line wasn't used, but Sheryl Sandberg shared it with Jon Favreau, who was traveling with the president. John instantly recognized that the SpongeBob comment would be funnier coming out of the president's mouth. Sheryl connected John and me via email, and I was happy to serve my country by contributing a throwaway line. The next evening, at a San Francisco fundraiser, the president used the SpongeBob quip. I know because it was quoted in news outlets. This is one of the differences between writing for a president and writing for a TV character. When the president cracks a joke, it's news. The timing of Sheryl's introduction turned out to be ideal. The White House Correspondents' Dinner was coming up in less than 2 weeks, and John invited me to send in jokes. It was the greatest moonlighting job ever. After spending the day on a set in Toronto, I'd take a pad of paper to the sushi bar and scribble jokes for the leader of the free world. My jokes fell mainly into two categories: topical humor, based on the news, and character comedy, based on the individual. If the president is willing to be self-deprecating, you have a classic sitcom character, the most powerful man on earth, who doesn't always get his way. Here's an example of a character joke I contributed to the Al Smith dinner, which brought together President Obama and GOP nominee Mitt Romney right before the 2012 election. "Ultimately, though, tonight is not about the disagreements Governor Romney and I may have. It's what we have in common, beginning with our unusual names. Actually, Mitt is his middle name. I wish I could use my middle name." The president punctuated the joke with tight lips, which made it even funnier. He may have been living in the White House with the nuclear codes, but at that moment, we all felt a little sorry for Barack Hussein Obama. Since it was my first time contributing to the correspondents' dinner, I tried an array of jokes, some character-based and some topical. I also threw in a few absurdist jokes to see if they'd fly. Here's a sampling. At top of speech, POTUS points, "Oh my God, there's Paul Rudd." "There are now three women on the Supreme Court." You know what that means? For the first time in American history, the Supreme Court can field a double Dutch jump rope team. I don't want to scare off any challengers, but anyone running for president should know the White House is haunted. Late at night, roaming the halls, you bump into former inhabitants, souls who are not at peace. Mary Todd Lincoln, Rahm Emanuel. One of them mutters the most foul things. And it's not the one you'd expect. I know some of my advisors are concerned about my current approval rating, but here's the thing. I live with two daughters, a wife, and my mother-in-law, so having any approval rating seems pretty good to me. None of these jokes made it in, and I admit, the Mary Todd one was a stretch. But I'm sharing them because they illustrate why a female perspective can lead to joke areas that male writers might overlook. Again, I don't believe only men can write for men and only women can write for women. Still, the Paul Rudd joke is something that a teenage girl, or I, would scream, which is why it seemed funny to put it in the president's mouth. Double Dutch was popular among the girls in my elementary school, so when I was brainstorming about what three women on the Supreme Court could do, that popped into my head. More perspectives lead to more opportunities for finding comedy. The 2011 Correspondents' Dinner turned out to be notable for two reasons. The next day, the world would learn that President Obama had ordered the Navy SEAL raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan before heading to the dinner. His coolness and good humor didn't give away the greater mission. That dinner also included a joke run that mocked the decision-making ability of reality TV star Donald J. Trump, who was sitting in the audience. Judd Apatow and John Lovett cooked up the hilarious takedown, and the entire room laughed loudly at the ridiculous host of The Apprentice. As someone who'd been making fun of Trump since my Spy magazine days, I couldn't believe this Queens-born failed casino operator was still in the public eye. Surely after this humiliation, the brass-loving steak peddler would go away for good. Instead, many have pointed to that night as causing the narcissistic injury which prompted his decision to seek revenge and run for office. After the 2011 dinner, Jon Favreau invited me to the White House to meet the other speechwriters. John Lovett kindly procured a photo that President Obama inscribed for me. The president thanked me for the jokes and added, "Glad I was able to provide the material." Sweet, self-deprecating, and funny. Each year I looked forward to contributing to that April evening so much that, starting in early March, I'd check my email nervously every morning hoping for a note from the White House. Each year I sweated it out, and each year the email would arrive. In 2013, I attended the dinner as the guest of Josh Marshall, founder and editor of my favorite news site, Talking Points Memo. The dinner included a weekend of parties leading up to the main event. Beltway dwellers love the chance to mingle with Hollywood stars. Since I get to do that in my day job, I was more excited to meet politicians. At one party, I watched fans flock to the magnificent Kerry Washington, while I kept my eye on a woman who was chatting with just one other person. When that conversation seemed to be wrapping up, I sidled over. "I wanted to meet you. I'm Nell Scovell." "Tammy Baldwin," she said, offering her hand. "Yes, I know, Senator," I said, shaking the hand of the recently elected first openly gay member of the Senate. "I'm so glad you won." Still, the best sighting came right before the dinner. I was milling around outside the ballroom when I saw the crowd start to part. Suddenly, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia swept by me like a Roman emperor flanked by bodyguards. He was smiling broadly and seemed almost animated, like a cartoon fire plug come to life with sparks flying all around. My old Wilton North Report pal Conan O'Brien delivered the comedy address that night, and I got to congratulate him at the Vanity Fair after-party at the French ambassador's residence. The backyard trees were strewn with blue lights, creating a magical setting. It's always a treat to see Graydon Carter, and I hugged my editor, Mike Hogan. Toward the end, I ran into the delightful Scott Berg by the fireplace. Scott and I had collaborated on a screenplay about a woman's college back in 1988. All my worlds were colliding in the loveliest way. After President Obama's final correspondence dinner, I figured my presidential joke-writing days were over. Then, in October 2016, speechwriter extraordinaire Jeff Nussbaum reached out to me about contributing to Hillary Clinton's upcoming L. Smith dinner address. I'd never written for the former Secretary of State, Senator, First Lady, and leapt at the chance. Her opponent, Trump, would also take part in this white-tie fundraiser for Catholic charities. Like President Obama, Secretary Clinton is a good sport and willing to wring comedy from self-deprecation. As with Letterman at the Kennedy Center Honors, I began by brainstorming an opening line. At the time, one of Trump's unfair criticisms was that Secretary Clinton lacked stamina. "She'll go home. She'll take a nap for 4 or 5 hours, then come back," candidate Trump once said at a rally. "No naps for Trump. No naps. I don't take naps." First, this statement convinces me that Trump takes naps. Second, it struck me as a good jumping-off point. I played around in this area and landed on a line for Clinton. "This is such a special event that I took a break from my rigorous nap schedule to be here." Amazingly, the way I heard it in my head was exactly the way she delivered it a couple of weeks later. 5 jokes Secretary Clinton didn't use at the Al Smith dinner. 1. Donald defines non-traditional marriage as between a man and a brunette. 2. "You know, we used to be friends. Donald even invited us to his wedding. And believe me, I'm sorry now that we didn't spring for the 10-speed blender." 3. On Dr. Oz, Donald said that he gets his exercise from moving his arms while he speaks. When I heard that, my eyebrows got a great workout. 4. Mike Pence keeps saying the country needs broad-shouldered leadership. Hey, maybe it's time for some child-bearing hips leadership. 5. Whoever wins, I think it's fair to say that the quality of basketball in the White House will drop. Clinton came across as relaxed, funny, and in control. Trump's performance communicated the opposite. During his speech, he delivered one solid joke, which came at the expense of his wife. Then Trump dropped all pretense that he was interested in participating in good-natured fun. He started punching below the belt. "Here she is tonight, in public, pretending not to hate Catholics," Trump said viciously. It wasn't a joke. It was a deceitful attack. I will never understand why Cardinal Timothy Dolan didn't stand up and say, "Hey, that's not funny." Humor can unite people of all faiths and political leanings, but Trump didn't want to be part of that. Or maybe he was incapable. Comedy requires empathy. A joke works because it builds off a shared feeling or perspective. Since Trump can't connect with the thoughts and emotions of anyone not named Donald J. Trump, that limits what he can find funny. People have said that Trump has no sense of humor. I disagree. He clearly finds humor in the misfortune of others. He once retweeted a doctored video of him hitting a golf ball and knocking Clinton over. It's Schadenfreude with a laugh track. Despite Trump's nasty comments at the Al Smith dinner, Clinton enjoyed the highest poll numbers of her campaign that week. She was on a roll. Exactly 1 week later, James Comey released the infamous letter saying some of her emails had surfaced on Anthony Weiner's laptop. None of the emails turned out to contain classified information, but her poll numbers plummeted. Colin and I were in New York City on Election Day, also known as November 8th, 2016, also known as my 56th birthday. Ed Solomon, one of Hollywood's funniest writers, invited us to his apartment to watch the returns and eat chili. As polls were closing, I passed the hotel on 6th Avenue where Trump was holding his post-election party. The white men in their red Make America Great Again hats looked apprehensive, and I briefly allowed myself to think that Clinton was going to win. My spirits soared. Her administration would battle climate change. It would protect those who need protection. A female would finally lead this country. I knew that wouldn't end sexism, but it would signal progress. The rest of the night was a long slide from jubilation to despair. The most qualified, experienced public servant ever to run for president lost to a racist, draft dodging, greedy, sexual assaulting, pathological lying, short-fingered vulgarian. I excused myself from Ed's chili party early and walked the 4 miles from Soho to the Upper West Side. The very air felt different, polluted by the nation's choice. The next morning, I called my 88-year-old father and broke down.
How could they have voted for him?
I asked, sobbing like a child. It'll be okay, Mel said. I hoped he was right, but it now occurs to me, this may be the only time in my life that my father ever lied to me. 5 unused jokes I submitted for President Obama's final White House Correspondents' Dinner. 1. Welcome. I know many of you came tonight to see the charismatic leader of North America, but Justin Trudeau couldn't make it. 2. I turned 50 while in office, which meant I had to have my first colonoscopy, and guess what they found? Mitch McConnell. That guy can obstruct anything. 3. The Republicans are working hard to change the Constitution. They want to shorten the First Amendment to Congress shall make no law. That's it. 4. If Trump wins, he gets the nuclear code. I'll give him a hint now. It's the same number that's on my Kenyan birth certificate. 5. People ask me who I'd like to see as our next president, which is touchy. It's a little like asking who I want to see as Michelle's next husband. I mean, come on, man. I'm still doing the job. Chapter 19. Stage 5 of a Hollywood writer's career. Don't die. It interferes with everything. Irving Brecker, 1914 to 2008. Irv Brecker and I met in 2005 and became instant friends. We had no choice. Irv was 92, and there really wasn't time to let a relationship unfold. We crossed paths at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, where I was sitting in the audience for a showing of a 1939 Marx Brothers film. At the Circus is not as well known as Duck Soup or Horse Feathers, but it holds its own thanks to the catchy Lydia the Tattooed Lady and Irv Brecker's absurdist script. Remarkably, 65 years after Irv thought up the gags, people were still laughing at them. The screening ended, and Irv was helped to the stage by an old spy colleague, Hank Rosenfeld. Tall and commanding, Irv opened strong. "My eyesight's not so good," he said, "but my wife tells me the theater marquee reads Irving Brecker Live." He paused. "That'll be a surprise to my doctors." I fell in love. Irv's credits are legendary. He received sole writing credit on 2 Marx Brothers movies. He turned his radio show, Life of Riley, into a sitcom, which launched Jackie Gleason's career and won the very first Emmy for Best Film Made for and Shown on Television. Clearly, the industry was still confused about how to label the new medium. Irv directed Ernie Kovacs' final movie and co-wrote the screenplays for Meet Me in St. Louis, Bye Bye Birdie, and Shadow of the Thin Man. He even punched up The Wizard of Oz. Groucho Marx and S.J. Perlman once set out to name the 3 quickest wits in America and landed on George S. Kaufman, Oscar Levant, and Irv Brecker. Since the other 2 were unavailable, I befriended Irv. Irv and his wife, Norma, lived in a high-rise condo on Wilshire Boulevard, and I'd visit them on Sunday mornings. Irv would tell me stories about fishing with Groucho and golfing with Jack Benny. His close friends included Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg, songwriters of Lydia and Somewhere Over the Rainbow. We'd talk about subjects we both loved, like old Hollywood, Jewish food, and Broadway shows. One summer, I came back from a trip to New York City. I saw a wonderful revival of South Pacific at Lincoln Center with Kelly O'Hara, I gushed to Irv. "I was there for opening night in 1949, he replied. "Al Jolson couldn't use his tickets, so he gave them to me. Mary Martin was great, but I loved Myron McCormick. it was impossible to one-up Irv. Often we discussed politics. Irv was a lifelong Democrat, but the world was changing fast, and sometimes it was hard to keep up. "Irv, I've never asked you," I once said. "What's your opinion on gay marriage?" "I'm fine with it," he said. "I just haven't found the right guy." Mostly, we talked about show business. Irv's agent had been dead for over 25 years, but that didn't stop Irv from complaining about him. Irv even held on to his anger at studio executives for miscasting the female lead in At the Circus. "I could have had Kitty Carlisle Hart," he said, shaking his head. But Irv wasn't living in the past. 6 decades after he helped invent the sitcom, his fertile mind was still hatching new premises. "What if," he would begin, "what if there's a divorced couple and the wife remarries a guy who lives in a luxury apartment, so the ex-husband takes a job as the building's concierge in order to be closer to his son?" A solid pitch. And like most writers, Irv had already started casting the series in his mind. "Louis C.K. would be terrific for the concierge," he said. "And for the wife, I'd cast that young, blonde girl. You know, what's her name? Amy Poehler? Bette Midler." Bette was 65, but to Irv, she was still an ingenue. Irv asked me if I'd be interested in writing the pilot with him. "I'd be honored," I said. "Good," he said. He paused and then added, "I just want one more shot." Those 6 words pierced my heart. Irv's fervent desire was either the most inspiring or the most depressing comment I'd ever heard. At 93, Irv still felt the pull of Hollywood. We are all seduced by the softly whispered come-ons of success, even when we know the odds of creating a hit movie or TV show are ridiculously low. Success in Hollywood requires the right concept, the right execution, the right casting, the right production team, the right outlet, the right marketing, and it all needs to come together at the right cultural moment. There are so many variables, and writers don't fully control any of them. In his seminal 1983 book, Adventures in the Screen Trade, William Goldman leveled Hollywood in 3 words. Nobody knows anything. Specifically, Goldman meant that nobody knows anything about how a movie will perform at the box office. His book offers examples, including Universal turning down George Lucas's proposed space opera called, what was it? Oh yeah, Star Wars. Rejection and failure are the bread and butter of this gluten-free, non-dairy town. Over a decade ago, I bumped into a talented comedy writer who had recently turned 40. Work was not coming as easily, and his agent was no longer responding quickly to his calls. My friend was shifting into the get me a younger, cheaper phase of his career. I was struggling too. We commiserated. "I need a new paradigm for success," he sighed. I knew exactly what he meant. In the previous decade, I had spun through a dozen paradigms, desperate to duplicate the success of Sabrina. I tried high-concept shows. I tried low-concept shows. I teamed up with talent. I ran with the studio's idea. I ran with the network's idea. I ran with my passion project. I developed TV shows based on books, movies, and even a sales video. 1 year, CBS digitally inserted Leslie Moonves into old TV shows for the annual advertising upfronts, and the video was so well received that the network hired me to write a pilot about a modern-day sheriff who gets advice from a rotoscoped Andy Griffith. I was trying and failing to crack the Hollywood code. Then in 2008, I gained some clarity. At the height of Desperate Housewives, I got a call to meet with Terry Hatcher, who had a development deal at ABC. The actress had sold a concept to the network about a woman who discovers that her daily horoscope is remarkably accurate. I thought it was a clever device and a terrific way to create internal conflict. For example, what if one morning the woman's horoscope tells her, "Avoid major decisions today," and then at dinner her boyfriend proposes. Terry gave me the thumbs up to develop her premise. I made the lead a lawyer who loves rules and resists the notion that the stars affect her life. The network approved our pitch, and I went off to write. 2 months and many drafts later, all signs were positive as the script landed on the desk of the network president. He read it that night and passed the next morning. According to my agent, the network president liked the characters, he liked the setup, he just didn't care for the horoscope concept. "You're kidding me," I said. The rejection didn't stun me, but the reason given did. It meant the exact thing that sold the project in the first place led to its downfall in the end. If you're confused, imagine how I felt after 2 solid months of work. I called my friend Rob Bragan to vent. Rob is wise and judicious. His nickname at Murphy Brown was the Professor, and I trusted him to make sense of what had happened. He pondered my story for a moment. "Well," he said, "there's nothing to be learned from that." I gasped audibly. Instantly, I knew Rob was right. Not just about this situation, but about most situations in Hollywood. Like Los Angeles itself, the entertainment business is built on shifting ground. Each experience is unique, shaped by personalities, emotions, timing, and, for all we know, the stars. There's no code to crack. There's no paradigm to follow. Instead, the system operates on gambler's reinforcement, where intermittent success becomes a motivator. Studies show that if a rat presses a lever and randomly receives a food pellet tied to that action, the rat will keep pressing that lever all day long. Yes! Woo! Now again. Pressing the lever may lead to insanity, but how else are you going to get a pellet? So the rat spends his day in a nice cage with some water to sip. It's really not that much different from a writer's room. And lever pressing isn't the worst job in the world. Sure beats maze running. I can even picture 2 old rats sitting around telling stories. Remember the time 3 food pellets came out in a row? Man, that was something. This mentality explains why Irv still longed for one more shot. The flip side of the depressing nobody knows anything is the far more optimistic and Jewishy, you never know. That's why I continue to churn out scripts. I expect nothing, hope for something, and am delighted when my efforts are rewarded. There's opportunity in confusion, and Hollywood has a lot of opportunity. Even after 3 decades, I truly don't understand how the system works. But I do know that the only paradigm for success is to keep looking for a paradigm for success. In 2014, after some furious lever pressing, a nice fat pellet popped out and I went back on a sitcom staff for the first time in almost 2 decades. Big Bang Theory co-creator Bill Prady came up with a brilliant way to reboot The Muppet Show, making Miss Piggy a talk show host and shooting the series documentary style. Like everyone with a soul, I grew up loving Jim Henson's creations and swooned at the chance to add to the Muppets canon. I joined the series as a co-executive producer. My first week on the show, I approached Bill Beretta, the Muppets' wildly gifted producer, director, performer, who voices Pepe the King Prong, Ralph the Dog, and the Swedish Chef, among many others. I had an idea, but it required one small, curly piece of information. "Bill," I said, "does Miss Piggy have a tail?" "Huh," he said, unsure. "I guess." Then he grew more confident. "Yes, she's a pig. She must." "But we've never seen it?" I asked. "Not that I know of," he said. "Could we see it?" I asked. "I don't see why not," he said, flashing a mischievous smile. I set off to develop a story I was dying to write. It began with Miss Piggy on the red carpet posing for photographers. Suddenly, she experiences the pig equivalent of Janet Jackson's nip slip, and her tail pops out. The newspapers plaster the embarrassing photo on the front page. Normally confident, Piggy is embarrassed by the mishap. She's not some tail-flashing barnyard animal. She explains her discomfort to her customer, Uncle Deadly.
Miss Piggy, my whole life I've tried to cover the fact that I'm a pig.
Uncle Deadly, you are aware that your name is Miss Piggy.
The issue, Piggy explains, is that her fans see her as a lady, not a pig.
Piggy plans to publicly apologize for the incident until a family values group starts body-shaming her and picketing the show. The protest backfires when Piggy wakes up to our culture's double standards.
Miss Piggy, what's so offensive about my tail? Look around.
Piggy starts pointing out Muppets and their tails.
Fozzie's tail is out. Bobo's too. And Yolanda's? Or is that okay because hers is long and thin?
Yolanda, thanks for noticing.
Kermit, Piggy, I see your point, but it'll blow over a lot faster if you just apologize.
Miss Piggy, I refuse. I've been hiding for too long.
Takes off her sunglasses.
The fact is, I grunt and snort and have a tail. That is who I am. I'm a lady and a pig, and it's time the world caught up with me.
A Tale of Two Piggies, which I co-wrote with Steve Rudnick, was a joy to produce. Watching Eric Jacobson perform Miss Piggy was a masterclass in both puppeteering and acting. There's an obvious irony that a human man plays a female pig, but Eric takes the responsibility seriously. At one point, he came over to me on set, uncertain how to play the line, "I'm a lady and a pig." I explained that I saw this as a moment of self-actualization rooted in my own experience. All my life, I hated it when people called me a female writer, I said. I wanted to be perceived as just a writer. The world saw me as my gender, and I saw myself as my accomplishments. But as I've aged, I've embraced my identity more. Now I'm happy stating, I'm a woman and a writer. That's who I am. And I want Piggy to stop denying who she is, too. I want her to realize that her pigginess is part of what makes her special. Eric understood and delivered the line beautifully. He also added a great gag to button the scene. As Piggy becomes radicalized, she declares, "I'm off to change the world." She starts to exit in one direction, then, a beat later, does a 180.
"The world is that way,"
she says, scurrying off. The Muppets was canceled after a partial season. It's a long story, so let's just say there were too many Swedish chefs in the kitchen. I took a break from TV to edit Option B, written by Sheryl Sandberg and Adam Grant. The project was a sobering look at how to face adversity and build resilience. Sheryl shared the overwhelming grief that she and her family felt after her extraordinary husband, Dave Goldberg, died suddenly at 47. She also shared her determination to recapture meaning and joy. The book could not have been a bigger tonal departure from writing for the Muppets. Like Piggy, I pulled a total 180. The world is that way. I have no idea what the future holds for me, which is both exciting and frightening. Irv once told me that his biggest regret was that he stopped writing at around age 50. He urged me to keep being creative, with one caveat. "Promise me, honey," he said to me in the hospital, "that you won't take any project that your heart isn't in." I promised him that I wouldn't. Irv died the next day. I think he would want me to recount his last joke. That same visit, the hospital phone rang and I answered. The kitchen needed Irv's lunch order. I passed along their questions. "Any allergies?" He shook his head. "Any dislikes?"
"George Bush,"
he replied loudly and without hesitation. I held the phone up so he could hear the hospital worker laughing on the other end. I hated leaving his side that day, but Irv was tired. The next day I called to see if I could come back. Irv said he didn't feel up for a visit. "I love you," I said.
"I love you, too," he replied. I miss Irv, and wish I'd met him 20 years earlier. I think often of his advice to work only on projects that my heart is in. Cheryl said something similar in her commencement address at Barnard. She urged each graduate to try and find a job that matters to you and matters to others. It's a luxury to combine passion and contribution. It's also a clear path to happiness. Cheryl definitely wrote those sentences herself, because I didn't know this principle was true until after we worked together on Lean In. Combining passion and mission is a clear path to happiness. Nothing is more satisfying than having a positive impact on people's lives. This realization also helps explain why I love writing jokes. On a much smaller scale, laughter is a sign of impact. That impact may be fleeting. A laugh may be over in the wink of a president's eye. But for me, that moment is bliss. 30 years after I broke into Hollywood, I'm still pressing that lever, hoping for a pellet. In an ideal world, I'd get to direct another movie. Or maybe I'll create and run another show. I just want one more shot. And then one more shot after that. And then... the end.
This is Amy Hone. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking Into the Hollywood Boys Club by Nell Scovell. This program was directed by Nell Scovell with David Rapkin and recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. Engineered by Catherine Cook. It was produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Katie Ostroka. Text Copyright 2018 by Nell Scovell. Production Copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.